The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
The Thucydides trap is a phrase used to describe the phenomenon of a rising power and an established dominant power almost always breaking into conflict. It's supposed to imply a self-fulfilling prophecy, because even if the incumbent power eventually wins, it more often than not does so at far too great a cost. In that context, it's worth considering if the current trade war between China and the US may not just be a prelude to a new technological Cold War between the two powers, but a much hotter and dangerous one for the global economy. This is Alpha Chat, a project from the Financial Times and the Rhodes Center for International Economics and Finance at Brown University. I'm Isabella Kaminska. A number of geopolitical and financial risks is stalking the global economy, pointing to a possible recession in 2020. Key among them is the US-China trade war and general protectionism in the global market, according to Nouriel Roubini, professor at NYU's Stern School of Business and CEO of Roubini Macro Associates. Already famed for his economic prediction skills, he nonetheless points out it's still a question of if, not when.
Well, I don't believe that the recession occur mechanically in a deterministic cycle, even if in the US experience, on average, about 10 years a recession has occurred. But there have been, you know, plenty of exceptions. You know, Australia has not had a recession for almost 25 years. Of course, they've been riding on the China boom and demand for commodities. Usually, recession occur not because expansion die of a natural death, but because there is a shock. And a shock could be, say, an oil price shock, could be that for other reason inflation gets out of control, the Fed is behind the curve, and then they have to put the foot on the brake, and that slowdown causes a recession. And the third type of it is when you have an asset and credit bubble that gets out of control and then the goods bust and then the financial and banking crisis causes a credit crunch and a bust of housing or other credit markets, and then you have a recession like 1990 and, of course, the Great Recession of 2007-2009. So we need to find the macro triggers, the policy mistakes or the financial imbalances or the geopolitical other shock that trigger that recession. What I'm arguing is not that we need to have a recession next year because we have been already in 10 years of expansion, but rather that there is a long list of factors. All is one of them, but I would say that the key one that I pointed out a year ago in my piece on a 2020 recession was the risk of a generalized set of protectionism and trade wars between US and not just China, but also other trading partners, but I was particularly concerned about the US-China. And I pointed out that this would not be just a trade war, but it will become also a technology war, as the US fears that China is going to dominate some of the technologies of the future. So a trade war, a tech war, and also a geopolitical war. I pointed out that in addition to oil shock and trade shocks, tariffs, there are also other U.S. policy that may lead to stagflation, slower growth, and higher inflation. One is restriction to immigration that reduced the supply of labor in a tight labor market. Another one, as I pointed out, was restrictions to trade in technology, data, semiconductors, and so on, that then imply deglobalization, balkanization, and disruption of global supply chains. If the US were to go ahead with keeping Huawei on the list and not allowing them the exemption they have right now of buying for a few months US semiconductors, you'll have at first a massive disruption of the entire global supply chain of tech and semiconductors. And anyhow, after what happened with ZTE and now Huawei, the Chinese have decided that over the next few years they're going to rely on semiconductors produced either at home or in safe countries and allies, but that's going to take several years. So, you know, the tech shock and this disruption in tech and global supply chains is going to be a massive shock. And the U.S. is now imposing severe restriction on inward FDI, not just by China, but also other countries, and not just in tech, but in a wide range of sectors. So you're in a world in which you're going to restrict trade in goods, in services, in capital, in labor, in technology, in data, and so on and so on. And therefore, this is a major kind of supply side shock to the global economy. And the combination of all these factors and the US-China trade and tech war that leads then to a broader geopolitical Cold War, given the rivalry between US and China, could be the trigger if it escalates from the current level of tension to a full-scale trade and tech war, could be the trigger for a global recession by next year. And if the shocks are large enough, my view is that even if the Fed were to take insurance cuts, even if the Fed were to more aggressively cut rates more than 50 basis points, even if the ECB, BOJ, and other central banks were to ease, if the shock is large enough, we are not going to avoid the recession. Same thing happened in 07, 09. Central bank aggressively cut rates. The Fed at that time had plenty of headroom from 525 all the way to zero. This time around, they're only having 250 basis points of headroom. ECB and BOJ have much less. They're already in negative policy rates. So central banks have more constraint on how much they can do in terms of conventional and unconventional. The shocks can be severe. And if the shocks are severe and central banks are aggressive, we're not going to avoid a recession. Meaning that if there is a full-scale trade and tech war between US and China, is one of the three scenarios out there, then we'll have a recession, even if you have aggressive monetary policy response.
I want to revisit the idea of the central banks basically having run out of bullets in a little bit. But I'm going back to China and the US specifically. In your recent piece, you talk about what you describe as the Thucydides trap, and this sort of idea that because one is an aspiring power and the other one is a legacy power, there is inevitably going to be some sort of standoff at some point. Because obviously at the moment, when you look at the China trade war, there's a lot of very emotive coverage and everyone's putting a political spin with respect to how they view Trump and whether he catalyzed it. But I think what I found interesting about your piece is that it was very pragmatic, and it sort of very concretely pointed out there are just reasons for why the US might be concerned about China's trade behavior in recent years. But equally, China has its own view on why it should be allowed to influence politics beyond its own borders. So where are you going with this analogy of the Thucydides trap? Is the idea here that we will eventually end up in a sort of Cold War type reinvention?
Yes, it is. You know, in that piece, I did not take a normative approach of saying U.S. is right, China is wrong, versus China is right and U.S. is wrong. I took more like an historical and geopolitical realist approach that says, you know, what happens when you have a new rising power facing an existing power? You know, I was in November of 2015, a year before Trump was elected in China as part of a delegation. We went to the Great Hall of the People, met Xi Jinping, President Xi Jinping, and he started the first 10 minutes of his remarks totally unprompted, literally speaking about the Thucydides trap and arguing that history is not deterministic and the rise of China will be peaceful. And as you know, Thucydides was the great Greek historian. They wrote the history of how a rise in Athens became a threat to Sparta, and then this confrontation between rising and existing established power led to war. And this was 2 years before Graham Allison from the Harvard School of Government wrote the book, Destined to War, Will U.S. and China Avoid the Thucydides Trap? And what it writes in the book is that in 12 out of 16 historical episodes, whenever you had the rising power facing an existing one, actual hot war has occurred. 12 out of 16. Now, I do not expect for now a hot war between US and China, but the reality is that you have a power is rising, 1.4 billion people, even if the population will shrink, is going to become the number one economic, financial, trading power in the world. Any power that is rising, even if it's not aggressive, has to have a defense to defend shipping lanes and its own interests. And therefore, some of the military buildup of China in Asia around the world is totally defensive. U.S. instead thinks of it as being aggressive. U.S. doesn't want to abandon its own hegemony that has had since World War II in Asia around the world. And therefore, to see this trap will occur. And the question is going to be whether it's severe or is less severe, and whether at least it's going to be only a cold war as opposed to a hot war. So regardless of whether U.S. and China reach a deal on trade in the next few months, and I think it's not likely, that greater rivalry about technology, about AI, about 5G, about who's going to dominate the industries of the future, on restricting trade in capital, even restricting Chinese students and researchers from coming to the US, restriction of transfer of technology, of science, of information, of data, and privacy. We are on a collision course. This Cold War will occur, regardless of whether the Chinese blame it on the US and the US on China. And both sides, of course, have done things that, from a global point of view, are not desirable and optimal. So as an historian, you have to think of it as realistically, not how the world should be, but how the world is likely to be. And therefore, I see this Cold War coming.
To what degree do you think that is still being fueled by ideological differences? I mean, you mentioned in the piece that, you know, the Chinese pursuing a very Orwellian surveillance society is something that doesn't square very well with Western values. Do you think those are the sorts of concessions that the US wants out of China, that it will not be pursuing that sort of agenda beyond its core borders? And especially when you look at the Belt and Road initiative, there is this sort of suspicion that fundamentally it's all about gaining more and more power for China, and that I would imagine means quid pro quo, the dispersal of the Chinese ideological sort of position on things.
I think that actually this time around, the ideological differences are less than in the Cold War between the US and the Soviet Union, where you had on one side, you know, beacon of capitalism and market economy as opposed to socialism and communism. Because, first of all, China, while being nominally socialist or communist, it's a, you know, it's a market economy, a mixed market economy, call it state capitalism. And they're not trying to spread a communist ideology around the world. And on the U.S. side, at least under Trump, in the past, we were defending, you know, liberal democracy, freedom, rule of law, and other things. But Trump and this U.S. administration really doesn't care about that stuff. So actually, the ideological differences are really minimal. And yes, China is creating maybe a surveillance state, but, you know, in the U.S., is not maybe the state that controls all those data, but in the U.S., between, you know, Facebook and Google and Amazon and you name it, you know, they have huge, massive control on private data, and there are issues of privacy, even the U.S., and these great tech giants are becoming even more powerful. So we may become a private Orwellian society as opposed to one dominated by the state. So I think ideology is the least of it. This is simply a sheer quest for power. Who's going to be controlling the global economy and global geopolitical role of controlling the seas, the Eurasian mass, and so on, has very little to do with ideology by itself. It's really a pure Thucydides trap, in my view.
But you do say that you think China wants the capacity to shape global standards on things. What would be China's position? I mean, what are the standards that it's trying to influence? What's our problem with their perspective on how these global standards are being shaped?
Well, you know, the standards of the global order, economic and trading, but also geopolitical, you know, were set by the victorious US and its allies after World War II. And we did create, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, eventually WTO, build up the UN and so on. And those are institutions that were Western, based on Western ideas, even if many of them had universal values. You know, China started to have influence in some of these institutions, but they got tired by the fact that in spite of their own economic weight, their chairs and shares in the Bretton Woods institution like IMF and World Bank were less, and they started creating, say, alternative institutions like the BRICS banks, AIB, and you name it. Now, I don't know what is the right system, for example, for dealing with international trade in goods, in services, in capital, in labor, in data, in privacy. There are a spectrum of views, and most of the traditional WTO dealt mostly with goods, barely with services, let alone capital, labor, data, technology, information. I'm saying is that if we do want to have a new global economic order that doesn't lead to full deglobalization, full Balkanization, certainly China, India, and other powers have to be at the table and shape together with US and Europe those rules of the game. And maybe there is, in spite of the rivalry, and that's my hope, a way of containing the trade and technological and other tensions, even rules of the game about cyber warfare that prevent the globalization and Balkanization is going to be a disaster for the world. If we're not able, you'll have a US system and you have a Chinese slash Asian system, each one of them with separate AI, separate internet, separate 5G, separate rules on trade, on investment, and so on, and we'll have full deglobalization. And that's not a world I want to be in, but I'm saying that both sides have to sit down and figure out what are the terms of that, and have less to do with politics and what you do domestically with your population. Whether we like it or not, China is an authoritarian country, but they believe that their own benevolent, technocratic, authoritarian system led by AI and a bunch of Mandarin bureaucrats gives a much more material wealth and success to the collective than our Mimi society, where there is gridlock, dysfunctionality, and where liberal democracy is failing. So, I mean, those are ideological differences we're not going to bridge, but we have to live in a world in which different great powers are going to have different political systems, but we can still live and share together this planet, because there are plenty of problems that are requiring collective public goods, and we have to resolve them, including the rules of the game on how you deal with each other internationally.
It's a fascinating sort of prediction if things go wrong, i.e. that you get this bifurcated world between China and US, but also you say that countries won't necessarily be able to stay neutral. These two powers will in some ways demand that third parties align themselves to one or the other. And in that context, I was just thinking, you know, obviously we saw the Hong Kong protests. What happens, do you think, if this keeps escalating? What happens to financial centers like Hong Kong?
Well, if we do go towards a full scale trade, tech, and Cold War, and that's certainly one of the three possible scenarios. The other two are you get a deal on trade and tech, and the other one is this war continues but is contained and doesn't fully escalate. And I think that we're in that middle scenario right now. We hope that we get a deal on trade and tech, but the risk is that the sides are escalating the wars of words, and also the actual action that's going to lead us to a full-scale trade tech and a trade war. But in that full-scale war, essentially both sides are going to say either you are with me or you are against me in terms of your trade, financial, technological links, and so on. Either you use my 5G or you use the Chinese 5G. Either you use my AI or the Chinese ones. Either you use my technologies and tech of the future or the Chinese. And unfortunately, the problem is that many of the countries are in between, whether in Europe or Asia, Middle East, Africa, Latin America. Today, they're actually doing more trade and investment with China than with their allies like the US, even in Europe. But from a geopolitical point of view, Europe, Korea, Japan, some of the Middle Eastern countries, and so on, are allies of the United States. So economically, this country wants to do business with China and business with the US. and doing today more business with China. Geopolitically, they are still close to the US, and the US is going to say, sorry, given the threat of Huawei's 5G, you cannot use it. And they're sitting there on the fence, and they don't know what to do. So the damage coming from balkanization is not just the world split, the US and China, but everybody in between will have to take one side or the other. For a while, they're going to try to straddle, but gradually over time, if it's a full-scale war, like during the Cold War, you cannot straddle. Either you're on one side or the other side. And during the Cold War, it was easy because, you know, Soviet Union was a declining economic and demographic power, and there was almost no trade between U.S. and Soviet Union. So there were sanctions, did not disrupt anything in global trade and finance. Now we're fully integrated, U.S., China, Asia, Europe, in this global economy. And to disintegrate and to deglobalize and to balkanize is going to be a royal mess that's going to cause a U.S. and global recession in the short run.
In some ways, it's probably even more complicated than Brexit.
Much more complicated than Brexit.
Which I didn't think was possible. But yeah. I mean, I don't want to laugh because it's quite a frightening scenario. But yeah,
well, is Brexit to the power of 10? Because Brexit is, you know, small open economy trying to disengage from Europe, and they're going to maintain, even in a hard Brexit, some trade, financial and other links. And maybe there is going to be a soft Brexit, but this is a Brexit to the power of 10.
Before we get to Brexit, I did want to ask you about that. In the China context, do you think Hong Kong then would obviously have no choice but to align? I mean, it is obviously Chinese, but the protests show that there is a certain level of hostility and outreach to the West still. So will Hong Kong be vulnerable? And given its importance in the international sort of financial system, where does that leave China especially? And I would also ask, you know, we've talked about the vulnerability of the Western central banks, but what's the PBOC? I mean, in a trade war, if it does escalate, China too will be forced to kind of stimulate its own economy, I would imagine. So what's the kind of, you know, the debt levels there are at relatively high levels. So it's not coming from a total position of strength.
Well, you know, on Hong Kong, you know, when there was the agreement for the handover, the agreement was, you know, until 2047, you had one country and two systems, and China would respect the political freedoms of Hong Kong and so on. But the reality is that, you know, in the last few years, with President Xi Jinping becoming more authoritarian, and then you had the umbrella movement, the Chinese have decided to slowly tighten the screws, and it's not been just overnight with this extradition law, but as I go every year to Hong Kong, every year, slowly, you have more Chinese control of levels of powers and the influence who are going to be the ruling, you know, people in Hong Kong and so on. And now you have a key element, because until now, you know, you could protest against Tiananmen, against whatever not you want freely, and you knew you were safe in Hong Kong. But, you know, if you are a dissident and then you commit, unquote, a crime, according to China, not only you could be arrested and end up 6 months in jail like some umbrella movement dissidents did, but, you know, they can extradite you to China and you may rot for the rest of your life in Chinese prisons. So that's why this matter is more sensitive than others. I would have thought that maybe China would more slowly and gradually absorb Hong Kong in its own economic, legal, political system. But I think that this escalation of the Cold War between US and China has led them to say, I'll be tougher on Hong Kong. They might start also to be tougher on Taiwan, among other things, and so on, rather than be patient. So I think that the rise of the Cold War and electricity trap is part of the reasons why the Chinese now are more aggressive in pushing stuff that, of course, causes a reaction. Already people in Hong Kong, and I see it for the last few years, they are self-censoring. Dissidents, journalists, artist, anybody there, you're more careful to what you say because you could get in trouble. You start with self-censorship, then it becomes formal censorship, and then becomes something like extradition law. And if you say things you shouldn't, you end up in jail and you get extradited. It's a slippery slope. I fear that in spite of these protests, we're going to be on that slippery slope, slowly and gradually, maybe not totally overnight, but effectively, politically, China has already taken over Hong Kong. Now, Hong Kong can still remain a meaningful financial center as long as they maintain the rule of law for financial services, right? I mean, that's what China has been doing. Say, we're going to open up our financial markets. We're going to build up Shanghai and others as important regional financial centers and so on. Now, if there's a real crackdown, people are going to get nervous. But if they maintain the rule of law, at least on financial services, maybe people are going to still use Hong Kong as a major financial center. And it is still one. Of course, if they have a full Cold War between US and China, and now, you know, some Canadians embroiled in the Huawei case have been arrested. And I know of U.S. corporate leaders who are worried about going to China. And we know that actually some Chinese were literally arrested in their hotel in Hong Kong and taken over on the other side. Maybe if the tension rise, if you're a Westerner, you have to say, well, what happens if I live and work or visit Hong Kong and something happens, maybe even a trade spat between US and China, and I become actually a pariah. I become a pawn in that. I could be arrested and I could be extradited. If that were to happen, then Hong Kong as a major financial center would really diminish, or at least those who are expats that are a significant part of that offshore financial center might start to think twice whether they should be in Hong Kong or go back to London or New York or move to Singapore. We are not yet there, but that's a risk if there is a really a violent escalation of this stress.
Do you think these tensions would have come to a head irrespective of Trump, or do you think Trump has definitely been the catalyst?
I think that with Trump, they've accelerated in a way that makes this Cold War coming sooner and faster and more violent. But as I said, you know, President Xi Jinping was telling us about the risk of a two-city trap a year before Trump was elected, or he was barely running. And historians and geopolitical experts have been saying, you know, the rise of China is going to imply some degree of rivalry. You know, even under the Obama administration, Obama saw the rise of China. U.S. has had hegemony in terms of the security of Asia since World War II, wanted to maintain that hegemony. Xi Jinping said, no, we don't want U.S. hegemony, but we want equality, geostrategic equality in Asia. U.S. says, no, we want to maintain our hegemony in Asia. And Obama made that famous pivot to Asia. Now, the pivot to Asia could not be just sending 500 Marines to Australia. It had to have an economic pillar to anchor ASEAN and other countries to the U.S. rather than China, or have them be on both sides of it. And that pillar, the economic pillar, was TPP. That would have led these countries to have more trade and financial links with U.S. But Trump comes and they're literally the first week he's in power, the first thing he does, he says, I'm going to get out of TPP. So all these countries that were sitting on the fence and want to be in good terms with U.S. and China and build more links with U.S. While they build links with China and at the TPP, there is no TPP at the time where China is the BRICS bank and the AIIB bank, and it has its Silk Road and it has the BRI and has its own trade RCEP initiative. So gradually, the forces of gravity without TPP are going to move all these countries gradually and slowly into the economic trading and financial sphere of influence of China. And with that also politically and geopolitically, if you're Australia, you do so much business with China, politically you cannot attack China on rule of law, democracy, human rights, and all that stuff. You have just to shut up and self-censor yourself because so much of your success depends on China. So unfortunately, Trump on one side has escalated this war, but on the other side, he has absolutely no strategy on how to maintain a significant, if not hegemony. I think hegemony at this point is the past. The best the U.S. could achieve is to have a strategic balance between U.S. and China in Asia. Even that one at this point is at risk. And the idea that the U.S. is going to rely on a few allies to contain China, whether it's Australia, Japan, and India, I think for lots of very good reason is totally far-fetched. That's the strategy. To try to contain China is not going to work. And if you try to contain China, because under Obama, the strategy is we cooperate on many things, we compete on others, and we're trying to maintain good relations. Right now, instead, the new national security strategy of the US is China is a strategic competitor and rival, and we have to literally contain it. A rising power of like China, you contain it, is going to be rightly become defensive and then aggressive. There is no way that you can have containment of China without eventually having risk of not just a cold war, but eventually a risk even of a hot war. They're playing with fire, literally, with China.
And where does it leave Europe, and specifically the UK? What are your latest thoughts on Brexit and the growing likelihood of a hard Brexit in October?
You know, I mean, first of all, European Eurozone is in the middle, is its own sets of problems and fragilities, economic, political, and after the EU elections, you know, there are these populists that are not in power, but they're going to influence the debate on Europe. You know, on Brexit, I'm still of the view that I'm not sure that we'll have a hard Brexit. And I'm not sure for the following reason. Suppose that they choose Boris Johnson or whoever as the new PM on a hard Brexit campaign, meaning I go try to do a deal. If there's no deal, I'll have hard Brexit. There is not a majority right now in Parliament for a no-deal Brexit. They voted actually against it. So Boris Johnson is going to go to Brussels. Brussels is going to tell them essentially F off because you've been a jerk and no deal on the backstop or anything. Then it comes back and then there may be a vote of no confidence against him. And then he says, we should have a hard Brexit. But then there is a majority in Parliament says, no, sorry, no deal Brexit is not acceptable. Then it's going to collapse. And then there are only three scenarios. You go to new elections and anybody could win as a combination of things. Or two, gradually there is an increased majority of people who believe that we should have a second referendum. If you have election or a second referendum, the Europeans are going to give some extension beyond October 31st until those elections or referendum occurs. Or there is also a third scenario that you form a minority government, say, led by Labour, not Corbyn, but some moderate, because you have 14 days between the time when, say, Boris Johnson government collapses to form a new government before you need to go to election. And there's not unlikely that maybe you form that government, because many Tories knows that, you know, if you don't form that minority government, you go for elections and the Tories can be trounced, given what happened in the EU election with Farage. So, you know, you may have a minority government led by not Corbyn, by some other Labourite who's trying to negotiate another deal with the EU. Is on a short leash. That government can collapse any point with a no confidence vote. But maybe that government is able to make a deal for a softer Brexit with the EU, and that deal could be passed by Parliament. Or eventually you end up with elections and second referendum. So, but I would say that the probability of a no deal hard Brexit crashing out on October 31st to me looks like still a relatively low probability.
And I mean, Macron has warned that it would constitute a default. So it would be a shock for the credit markets. Or do you think that's not the case?
While the damage from a hard Brexit is bigger on the UK rather than the EU because of the trade links, the shock to business confidence coming from hard Brexit could be severe enough that actually that could be a tipping point for even the European Union and the Eurozone economy go into a recession. Because suppose you have hard Brexit and it's a bit of a chaos in spite of the preparations, and you have long lines at Calais, Dover, every port, and you have some ripple effects on financial markets, even if they say we prepared for everything, then that shock to business confidence implies that you already have all this other global uncertainty, US and China and Mexico and potential auto tariffs and you name it, and politics and EU elections and populists. You know, we're already in a massive slowdown because given the policy uncertainties, there's an option value of waiting. If you are any business in Europe, in the UK, in US, in China, emerging market, you don't do any more capex because you don't know how the world is going to be. So there's already a capex strike that is going to push the global economy into a stall. You get a hard Brexit, and even in the EU, that shock implies then a collapse of business sentiment that pushes the EU into a recession. So people say US greater bargaining power and leverage in a hard Brexit because most of the pain is on the UK. Not true. In this very fragile moment where everything is fragile and everything is uncertain, the shock of hard Brexit could hurt the European Union, the Eurozone economy as much as the UK. And then you end up into a true European and Eurozone recession. And I think the Europeans themselves realize it. They're tired of these Brits not knowing what they want. But jumping off the cliff of a hard Brexit on October 31st is too risky for both sides. And if the Brits have not yet come to reason and figure out in their schizophrenic brain what they want to do, I think that the Europeans are going to have no choice but give them another extension until another election, until another referendum, until another minority government, until maybe you even reverse Brexit. There is no choice, because the alternative is a jump into the unknown, and the unknown might be just a cliff and you all crash. So even a Macron, who said enough is enough, and many other Europeans, I was told in Brussels and Berlin and Paris recently, enough is enough. October 31st is a hard deadline. Unfortunately, it's not going to be a hard deadline.
But that just invites the possibility that we live in this limbo forever, like Schrodinger's cat, both alive and dead.
But better this limbo than the alternative, right? In the limbo, the UK is effectively still having full access to the single market.
The limbo
is great
for the
UK. Even if you had a deal for 2 years, you have full access to the single market, and then you have to negotiate the transition. So a limbo is not good and affects negatively business confidence, but that limbo and full access to the single market is better than hard Brexit, where it's like a shock to the system. It's not ideal, but between the two, I'd rather be in that limbo.
So we're starting to run out of time. And obviously, one of the topics I did want to ask you about in some sort of length was the emerging cryptocurrency parallel monetary system that is supposedly going to take over the world very shortly. Both you and I have critiqued the sector quite strongly. Is there anything that has recently come to your attention that sort of corroborates or has changed your mind or moderated your views in any shape or form? Or to the contrary, are you doubling up?
No, I maintain my views. In spite of the recent rally in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency, you know, in 17 they went Bitcoin from 1,000 to 20, and then in 2018 it crashed from 20 down to 3. Now it's gone up to 7. People say it's the beginning of a new spring. I don't believe it, because fundamentally these are not currencies. A currency has to be a unit of account, means of payment, stable store of value. And as we know, neither Bitcoin nor other are. They cannot scale, you know, 5 transactions per second, and with proof of work and alternative like proof of stake are not going to work, or going to lead to massive concentration and centralization of power and oligopolies. So the issue of scalability has not been resolved. Everything is centralized from miners to exchanges, to developers, to concentration of wealth. Is not a stable store of value over goods or services or even wealth, because the value can be going up and down 10-20% literally in a matter of hours. And nobody is using it as a unit of account. So I think even more than the past, in stable advanced economies with low inflation, is not going to become a means of payment. I think that one is completely dead and not improving in spite of all the talk about stuff. And then, you know, then people have realized it, and then people say, okay, cryptocurrencies and shitcoins and so on are not going to become the base of a new monetary system, but we have this great new technology of blockchain or DLT. But even in that technology, I think the reality is the following one. Because everybody is excited about corporate DLT. What they call blockchain is blockchain in name only. It's private, not public. It's centralized, is not decentralized. Is permissioned, is not permissionless. So they call it blockchain because it's sexy and it sells, but it's nothing but a glorified distributed database. And we've had distributed database forever. You know, I use Google Docs with colleagues, and we permission the 5-10 folks who can use it together, share and change document, has been there forever. And there are plenty of other technology. Nobody would call them DLT. Nobody would call them, blockchain, just distributed databases and so on. And those things are great, and they're going to be growing. But have nothing to do with DLT. Have nothing to do with blockchain. And there is no corporation, private or public, no government, is going to be willing to put all of their balance sheet, P&L, relation with customers and clients on a public ledger. And all these attempts among major banks to form even these R3 and other coalition have failed, because at the end of the day, they have to share data and they're all very territorial about their data, and they cannot resolve these things. That's why, you know, there have been tons of studies. You know, the people said we can use blockchain in, solving the world, the poverty, refugees, giving identity, banking the unbanked. There's been a study of 43 examples of using blockchain technology for doing goods for the world. Out of these 43 cases, case studies, proof of principle, zero cases have succeeded. There's not a single case. So all these people who say blockchain here, blockchain there, and everybody is now adopting it, they're all proof of concept experiment. They have all 100% completely failed. And the thing that they call blockchain are not blockchain.
So to finish off very quickly, I thought I'd ask you, in the event of a 2020 global recession, how do these speculative shitcoins fare? What's the likelihood that they survive the recession?
You know, first of all, 81% of them were scams in the first place. 11% of them were dead or failing. So only 8% of all these ICOs were traded. And in 2018, actually, even of those that were traded, literally even the top 10 lost 92% of their value, while the other ones lost 99% of their value. So we had a year, actually, there was a risk-off. 2018 was an entire year of risk-off with tons of problems and risk in the global economy, started in February and reached the peak in Q4, where you had worries about China, US, Europe, the Fed, hard landing, trade wars, Italy exit, Brexit, EU election, you name it. And you had a massive sell-off, 20% collapse in US and global equities. And during that fourth quarter, you know, the shitcoins and the bitcoins of the world were still heading south and staying south. There was absolutely no idea that when there is a risk off, those are the things people are going to go into. If there is a real crisis, people are going to go into cash. They're going to go into bonds of safe countries. They may go, partially depending on which financial risk there are, maybe into gold. There is a wide range of assets that are safe havens, that are currencies like the dollar, like the yen, like the Swiss franc, and so on. But the idea that, you know, if there is a U.S. and a global recession, financial crisis, people are going to go into the safety of Bitcoin or thousands of shitcoins when they've been totally in disrepute and that most of them have collapsed, that's a total joke.
And on that note, I think I will invite you to come back again and join us to specifically talk about cryptocurrency. But the economy was also very important, so I felt we had to cover both bases. Nouriel, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me today, Izzy.
Alpha Chat is produced by Dan Richards at the Rhodes Centre for International Economics and Finance at Brown University and Amy Keane from the Financial Times. Please email us on alphachat@ft.com for any reason at all.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.